Blog Talk Radio.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation. Well, hello everybody. This is Will Bluewater, and our guest this evening is Alan Kent George. He's author of Encounters with Aboriginal Philosophers, Spiritual Histories, and another book called The 60s, Biography of the Love Generation. He's an elder. He's 80 years old, that he'll admit to. But anyway, welcome, and we have Mark the Badger with us and speaking with Alan in Hawaii. How are you, Alan?
I'm fine, fine. Aloha from Hawaii.
Aloha Nui. Are you Kama Aina yet?
Oh yeah. Well, we used to live here some years ago in the 70s, and we always wanted to come back. We left because it was too difficult to make enough of a living to raise five children, and we had five children. We came back, and so and our children are grown now, and we always wanted to come back because we were attracted here in the beginning because of the racial situation, which is, it seems mellower and always has to me here than in California, which was supposedly liberal. But when my wife, who was African American, and I walked down the street in the 1960s, we had to, people would yell at us, and she'd withhold me from getting into fights. So we came to Hawaii because we didn't have that problem here and still don't, and we're glad we're back.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. My first wife passed away in 95, but she lived there for a couple of years before she moved back to the mainland, and we got married. She always wanted to get me out there, but we never did. But Alan, you knew the Hopi elders back when? I mean, when they were, getting in front of bulldozers. Yeah, tell us. Tell us what you know. I didn't meet these guys till, nearly the 90s.
This was in the 1960s. My wife and I were both in the civil rights movement in the Congress of Racial Equality, and we participated in demonstrations against racial discrimination and segregated housing in the Los Angeles area. And the Congress of Racial Equality was approached by Hopi elders for help, as other groups like the Nisqually in Washington approached core people for help in their fishing rights. And where the Hopi were threatened by oil and mining, and I think they still are. So we formed a committee, Committee for Traditional Indian Land and Life. We call it initials TILL. Land and Life, those words we got from the Hopi, Techua Kachi, Land and Life, that's what it's all about. And we helped them in court. We provided legal assistance and for the Nisqually. And then we spent, my wife and I, and eventually our children, we all spent time on the Hopi Reservation. We'd go out, drive out there and camp in school breaks. And we learned about the, there were demonstrations there. They were bulldozing to bring in electricity into Hope Villa, the traditional village, and the elders were throwing the bodies in front of the bulldozers, risking their lives to stop electricity from coming into their village, which blew my mind apart. I couldn't understand that. I heard all about progress and development and so on, and I found that if they got electricity, they'd have to pay for it, and they have to get jobs and maybe give up farming. But it went much deeper than that, as I found out over the years, their respect for the land and life, and their prophecy. What amazed me mostly, above everything else, was that I watched the prophecy come true. In the 1960s, nobody had even heard of the word ecology. Nobody knew anything about the environment. All anybody talked about was development and more oil and more gas and nuclear power. And there was no counter voice, except maybe the Hopi, who of course were ignored. But that's what they were talking about. And now you have, like on the National Geographic, or the History, I guess it's the History Channel, maybe, they have, or maybe it's National Geographic, they have experts in different fields telling all the ways that in which the present course of humanity and its overblown population will result in disaster, just as the Hopi said. I mean, it's just, I'm hearing this 50 years later, and it's coming true.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, in your travels, did you ever run into a nice redheaded lady by the name of Zula Brinkerhoff?
Zula? No, I don't. We met a lot of people, and I don't remember all their names, but
she was Grandfather David's Monongi's adopted daughter, and she started being a spokesman for them back in the 1959, and she was
oh yeah
She's real active, and just wondering if you run into her.
I don't specifically, but we probably did. Yeah, David Monongi. I saw David every time we came out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he stayed with us in our home in Venice when he came to Los Angeles. He and James Coots and Ellen. Coots Shaughnessy. He called himself James Coots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lived in Santa Monica in 61, 2, 3, and 4.
Uh-huh.
Went to Franklin School.
Oh.
721 23rd Street. I lived about, what, 5-6 miles from you?
No, yeah, closer than that, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, you used to go down Santa Monica Pier, and you were just the next pier to the south, and we go down there every 4th of July, and they'd shoot the fireworks off from Pacific Ocean Park on the pier.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
Those were the days.
They were.
And the Santa Monica Pier, go down and fish. We had the same stomping grounds for a while. So you taught history, I understand.
Well, I taught. I've taught various things, every level from kindergarten to college, at various places. I've taught English. I have studied history, and I've written a little bit about it. And of course, in this last film that I've it's an educational film that I'm pushing now called Prophecy and Pollution. Why, it is history. It's the history of what's happening to indigenous peoples from oil and mining, and it's horrendous. I use images in this picture that they're not nice to look at, and that's what's being done. Of course, there are a lot in the film about Native Americans and the horrendous things that have happened to them, particularly from uranium mining. Oh, God, it's awful. But it's not just there in Latin America. We cover some of Latin America, cover Africa, even Asia. There's a tough and difficult number of images to look at, but we have to. I had to put over the point that this is around the world, and that it is not just one spot. There are a lot of places that we didn't cover. We didn't have pictures. We got what footage we could, but however we could, mostly through internet. And that's what's happening, and that's the history that is going on now. The colonial military colonialism, and that's long gone most places. But this is a kind of corporate colonialism, and it's like the military. It's unregulated, and that's what we put in the film. The film is, of course, presents the Native American, particularly Hopi, social life, and then the invasion of oil and mining again. Mm-hmm. The prophecy that said that's disaster. That's going to be disaster, and it's coming true.
Yeah, well, even old hardline Cold War conservatives like me, are beginning to see the picture. unless
we're all in it.
Stupid, and so some of us are. And I still hang around some military guys, and it's not like they're not paying attention.
It's capitalism, communism. They both do the same things. I mean, they both. They're all into, like as George Carlin would term it, more stuff. I mean, people were talking to somebody the other day about, they were using the terms backward and primitive. And I thought there's only one way in which this present so-called civilization is advanced, only one way. And that is, as George Carlin would term it, making stuff, making more stuff.
Yeah.
Televisions, airplanes, cars, computers, more stuff. stuff.
Invention.
That's what the Hopi said, that's not what life is about.
Yeah, invention.
There should be, I mean, it can be about that, if that's what you hear, but that's not, that's, I mean, that's all a civilization does. What about relations between people? I don't think this so-called civilization is advanced in that regard.
No, they're turning people into stuff now.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, before we know it, we'll see Soylent Green. You watch. You just watch.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you know, it was, you know, I mean, you know, my dad was, you know, my uncle was a coal warrior. My dad, you know, worked for in the defense industry. He ran a division for Donald Douglas. That's the reason why we're in California. And but, you know, they could still see, they knew there was something wrong, you know, some kind of conspiracy, and they didn't realize, you know, there was really more about, you know, corporate oligarchy, corporatocracy than, but, you know, every movement starts out good, and then they become a business, then they eventually become a racket. That's
yeah, really.
The pattern everything takes, and
yeah.
So yeah, so you got somebody's got to stand up on their hind legs and fight. And
well, and, yeah, we do what we can, you know. I hope that, like I saw on was it History or the National Geographic, one of those channels, the expert panel of different kinds of experts telling us the different kinds of ways in which present civilization is dooming itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than one way. They talk about I forget the different ways, but of course you have pollution, you have water, and you have a lot of things. There's just too many people wanting too much stuff.
Well, there's I have a friend. She's passed away now, but the Mormons knew that, you know, something was going to happen. They used to talk about it more and more, but back, and then the church just kind of moved on from it, and they just kind of ignore things. But back in the 30s, there was one fellow that worked closely with this concept. And there's always been an undercurrent of Mormons that, because Joseph Smith was told, and Brigham Young both told them, you need to go look at the Indians. And eventually, Joseph Smith's prophecy about 1890 being the year that something would happen, you know, came true, you know, 50 years after his death. Anyway, this one fellow's name was Loren Woolley, and this is back when Franklin Roosevelt was president, and he could see past where we are now and into the world we're headed in, and he said, shoot. And this is back when most Mormons were Republican. He says, folks, he says, let's do everything we can to speed it up. And he says, as for me, he says, I'll vote for FDR, you know, just anything. He says, because it doesn't matter who you vote for, but he felt like we could speed it up a little bit more if that was just, you know, but, you know, they both parties basically do the same thing. It used to be, you know, Democrats were known as tax and spend, but and the Bushes have done more damage. It's just unbelievable.
They're all.
Oh, and did you hear? Kissinger has promised the Chinese that Jeb Bush will be the next president.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's a nefarious man.
Tried for war crimes. Eh?
Oh, jeez. But anyway, didn't want to get you off course. And
yeah.
So yeah, just keep talking. Tell us just old home week and tell us what you remember.
Well, we used to go out there, like I say, on school breaks all the time, and we take our children with us and. They sometimes, David and James and Ralph Talangama, some of them would come to Los Angeles for various, we staged various no get-togethers for them, trying to get them support. And, you know, I think we helped out some, but they still have, you know, they're still trying to drill in mine out there.
Yeah.
I haven't been out there in quite a while, but I keep up with it on the internet, and there's constant protest.
So many Hopis converted to Mormonism, and then you've got Zion Security, and you know they're providing all the lawyers for Peabody Coal. I worked with these guys when I was with the Boy Scouts, you know, in Salt Lake, and George P. Lee was a good friend of mine, and they saw to it he was silenced, and he accused the church of genocide.
Ooh.
Because so they went out, eventually they went after him. They got some girl to swear that 6 years before that he'd, you know, propositioned her or something. But he was probably going to become chairman of the Navajo Nation, and they made sure that he, number one, that he couldn't go back to Arizona to run, and then they got him branded as a sex criminal. And it's too bad, because we used to spend, when he was principal of the high school at Tuba City, you know, we used to talk about, I'd call him for an hour or two and talk, and I'd say, you know, Elder Lee, you know, don't you have work to do? And, oh, no, I love to hear it, you know. But he went back to traditional ways.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But he was on the first bus of kids that a lot of Navajo and other Indian parents felt that they were just, you know, kidnapped, you know, they call it the Lamanite something program, you know, and it's a well-intentioned road to hell. And
that's apparently a common practice in our film Prophecy and Pollution. In the first part about the Hopi, James Coots talks about the fact that the soldiers would come out and surround the village, the traditional village of Hodvilla, and they would take the children. The parents would try to hide the children, but they'd hunt them down, soldiers, and take them 500 miles away. There's a boarding school in California, and they wouldn't come back for 5 years. And when they came back, they could hardly, Riverside is school, they could hardly speak Hopi, and all they could think about was getting jobs and making money. I just read on the internet, because I'm in some groups, LinkedIn groups, Native American groups, and there's I think it's Lakota. They're up in arms. They're really upset because I think something like 5,000 Lakota children have been taken away from their parents these places, these government places, take them and they get money for how many kids they have. And so the more kids they take, the more money they get. And they're taking 5,000 kids in, I forget the period, but so it, you know, that's.
And they're all sponsored by different. They're all sponsored by different churches, and I think the Catholic Church had the most influence on the Lakotas. I know Frank Fulscrow had two funerals, one a traditional one, and he had a cat. He was a Catholic too.
Well, Hitler was a Catholic, so
yes,
really
yeah, yeah.
I would like to say something to you.
Sure.
This is my wife, Gwendolyn.
Hi.
We've been married for 48 years, so you can trust her.
Hello.
Hi, Gwendolyn. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. Mark is on the line with us, and I'm Will.
Okay. Hi.
Yeah.
Hi, Mark.
Gwendolyn. This is Mark.
Hi. I just wanted to add the Hopi that we're talking about. You know, there are different groups, and these are the traditional Hopi. They're not. They're not a whole lot, because for various reasons, you know, but there are these groups of Hopi. some of them have worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and sort of represent the, you know, the status quo as much as they can, the tribal council. But the traditional Hopi were living in these areas, and they really, really wanted to live their traditions, and that was simplicity. And what I was most impressed with, or one of the things I was impressed with, you'd go there, and they always had an abundance of food because they really lived to the rhythms of the earth. Even when we went out in the fields and they planted, if you observe, there was a certain rhythm to the way they walked, and they put the seed in the ground, and they covered it, and then they walked on. And there was this rhythm, and their lives were so dictated by the natural rhythms that at a certain time they had to have things planted. I mean, you didn't go past that time, because if you wanted to have the food mature at the right time, they say they had been guided to that particular place. They never needed to water because there was always enough rain. They never needed to fertilize because where they had their fields, the silt would wash down each year. So it was like this really sacred, holy place. And their lives were simple, very simple. But when there were floods and snow, really big storms out there in the desert, they lived close to the Diné, the Navajo, the Diné, and they always had to airlift food into the Diné, but never to the traditional Hopi, because they had their food source so well preserved and taken care of, and they said the Great Spirit guided them. They had places under their villages where you'd go there in the summertime and it would be, you know, 100 plus degrees, and they bring a cold melon with no electricity from under the ground, a fresh melon or other fresh foods. And so I was really impressed by the fact that if you live in the cycles of the earth, if you eat what's indigenous to that area, you will always be provided for. And these were some of the most gentle people I have ever encountered. Now, remember, I'm not saying Hopi in general. I'm talking about the specific traditional Hopi.
The traditionalist, the Sinem.
Yeah, and so at one point, David Menangwe, he was the elder of the village. He was, I forgot, 120 years, 119. And so, yeah, I don't mean David. I'm trying to... I don't mean David. I'm sorry, I forgot. Dan Kachunga, that was his
Kachunga,
name.
Kachunga, right.
He was the elder of the village. He got up and walked, oh, how many miles was it, 30 miles or so? He left before the sun rose, and he had one of his great-great-great-grandchildren go with him because he was blind, and he walked all this distance. He didn't read papers, didn't have electricity to hear the news, walked down to where they were drilling for uranium and tells the people drilling that this is not okay what you're doing. It's not according to the plan of the Great Spirit, and you will cause destruction. Something, you know, I'm not quoting verbatim, but something to that, and turned around and walked back to his village with his great-great-great-grandchild leading him. And he called Alan and I. We were there. It was a real honor because they actually invited us to stay in the pueblos because after a certain amount of time they trusted us. So we got to stay in their village, which was a real honor. And one night when the snow was maybe 5 feet, they called us, Dan Kachunga called us into his home and just told us very simply through a translator, get out of the city, big shaky, get out of the city, big shaky. And he says, all that you see now is nothing new. He described big skyscrapers and all. He said, this is nothing new. I didn't know exactly what he meant, still don't. We thought maybe we were living in Los Angeles, maybe he meant an earthquake. We don't really know exactly what he was referring to. He just told us, get out of the city, big shaky, big get out of the city. So we moved, and we've been as much as we can living in nature in beautiful places. I don't know exactly what he meant, except that this man was blind. He couldn't read. He didn't have electricity, but he said, get out of city, big shaky. And then, of course, another thing that happened that we were honored, you'll see it on TV a lot, they took us out to the stones where their you know, where it had been predicted as to what would happen to the earth, you know, and the stone showed, I guess, the, here, let Alan continue. Honey, you continue. Oh, okay, he said I should continue. Okay, but it showed where they had written on the stones, and it showed what would happen if we just didn't keep into the natural cycle with the balance. And as Alan was saying earlier, it's so tempting to have the computer and have all this stuff that makes us have immediate contact with anyone around the world, and it goes fast. And then we have the cell phones that are so convenient. And, you know, just in the last short while, few weeks, the World Health Organization has actually come out with their research talking about the dangers of cell phones causing brain cancer. So all of these temptations, they look wonderful to us. They look, they make our lives faster and easier. But where do we get these? What are they doing to the earth? All the coal and all the people dying, and you know, and I don't have a solution. I really don't. I just know that for us, we always have a good garden, and our life is simple, and don't need a lot of things to be happy. And I think maybe that's what the Hopi are saying. If you can find the happiness and peace within yourself and allow other people to be themselves, whether you agree with it or not, but just, you know, learn forgiveness, that's another thing for the Hopi. That was just, I mean, it was remarkable. Their attitude, the traditionals about forgiveness. In the 60s, there were a lot of young hippies going to the Hopi Reservation because they'd, you know, it was a thing back then, the Indians, the indigenous. So they'd go to the Hopi Reservation. Many of them were totally disrespectful because they didn't really know what they were doing or didn't have any history of how to behave. And they were doing things that were, you know, just not respectful. You know, sex and the right in the open,
yeah,
and dressing certain ways. And just, you know, there are many things they were doing. But the Hopi always, their attitude was, they're our sisters, they're our brothers, they don't know. And so they would just not, they would just sort of ignore them, and if they came in contact, they'd be very polite. But they really, really exemplified forgiveness. And how do we live in this world? We have to realize that everybody is right where they're supposed to be at this point in time until they have enough information to change how they are. But one of the most important things was forgiveness, letting people be, and let's share the earth, and let's remember the rhythms and the cycles and respect all of that, and we can probably extend it, because if we do that, we're going to respect the plants. And in order to respect the plants, we're not going to try to destroy our environment, you know? And I think the other thing I learned from them is that we can destroy ourselves as humans. We cannot destroy the earth. We didn't create the earth. And I think of a really good example when Mount St. Helens erupted years ago, and then after it finally cooled down and the snows came back, there were all these little tributaries, and scientists went there, and they discovered for the no place else on this planet, they found the salamanders. They'd never found this particular species. So to me, it just points out, we cannot destroy the earth. We can destroy ourselves. And the simple message of the Hopi is, let's live in balance and harmony and respect each other and love each other and just, you know, find the happiness, find the joy.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like Jack Nicholson in Mars Attacks. You know, why can't we all just get along, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know what, really shocked me, you remember, oh, I guess when we first went into Iraq or something, you know, there was a Hopi. You remember when that young lady, they were a bunch of, they took a wrong turn, and they ended up getting ambushed, and she was captured, but one of the people that was killed was a Hopi, and I remembered, Thomas Bunyakia, you know, he went to jail during World War II because they were trying to draft him, and you know, now they're volunteering, you know, so.
Yeah.
And you're right about the food, because, you know, when I went to see Thomas, you know, he showed me the food storage inside of his house. They were taught to have 7 years worth of grain. And, there is, were you guys aware there's a Hopi permaculture group on Facebook?
No, I'll tell you, I don't. No, do you know that, honey, about this? No, I actually don't do Facebook.
Yeah, it's called
I think
Hopi.
Alan does, but maybe
Hopi,
he doesn't. Not
Hopi.
He doesn't either.
I do LinkedIn a little.
Yeah, he does LinkedIn. And I'll tell you another thing. You were mentioning something that had been in the news. At my age, I really, at this point, try not to listen to the news.
Yeah,
because
me too.
Because I've worked in the media, and I know what gets people's interest. It's usually bad news. And so rather than ingest that into my psyche or have to be aware of it, I try as much as possible not to know what the news is. And people say, well, how will you be informed? I say, well, there's always somebody who's going to tell me or ask me, you know. And I think, well, maybe I'm still living as an idealist at my senior age, and I think that's okay. I think if we had more elders who had more ideals, maybe we could find more joy and more laughter and happiness and not walk so bent over, walk upright,
yeah,
because we feel so good about each day, you know. So maybe I'm an idealist, and so no, I don't listen too much or look too much at the news.
Yeah. Well, while we got you on the line, would you like to know why you were that you were destined to be attracted to such things? My friend Mark can tell you, according to your Mayan birth date. Have you ever had your Mayan birth date done?
Now you're talking about Alan's birthday, right?
No, yours. Let's do your both of you.
Sure.
Oh.
If you don't mind giving up your birthday, including the year.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
So mine is 8/21/41.
2141.
And Alan's
August 21st, 1941.
Yeah, and Alan's is 10.
Hold on, we'll do one at a time because
I can
only handle one at a time.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll do yours first and we'll do Alan's.
Okay.
So August 21st, 1941.
Yeah.
Okay, in the Mayan traditional day count, you were born on a day called One Chican, and it is a day that it begins that cycle, so its energy carries through the entire 13-day cycle. And that energy is a lot about beginnings, great power. It would be associated with the lower part of a pyramid, so the first level, sort of. The Chican glyph is a day that has to do a lot with large scales of energy. It's also a serpent glyph, so in that would connect into the Hopi story about the twin serpent brothers at the north and south poles. And that would also tie in with in the other Mesoamerican on the Quetzalcoatl, the coatl part would be the serpent energy part. So things with serpent energy, and since you start that particular cycle, that means that carries even additional amounts of that type of energy. It's a red glyph, so that would connect to the east, the direction of the east on the Mayan medicine wheel. And the serpent would also connect into the stars of the Pleiades, because in their culture, one of the names for the Pleiades was basically the tail of the snake or the tail of the serpent.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably have some Pleiadian energy there in your life somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to go and take a little bit different view of things here now, and we're going to swing over to another mode. We're going to look at actually several time flows, and this is going to be more from the perspective of the coming world cycle, what the Hopi called the fifth world. So this is going to be a little bit more from the perspective of the fifth world looking back into our world cycle. This is going to be a little bit more, tell you a little bit more things about that type of viewpoint. And in that viewpoint, we see from your birth eagle energy. This is on what we call normal time, forward-moving flow of time. Eagle energy, so a lot of things showing since of things in birth having to do with energy, visions, revelations, eagle energy, mind energy, but not mind energy in terms of the way we think of normally think of mind, but mind energy relating to vision, dreams, that type of connection with mind.
Mm-hmm.
The particular linkage of the energy is in the direction of universality of all.
Yeah.
And healing with that. Healing and achievement, generosity. So kind of healing using mind, vision, and things for basically the benefit of all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'd say that probably kind of would be a real driving force in your life since birth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on another flow of time, this is moving backwards. So there's two flows of time here. One moving forward, which is what we normally think of time as doing, and the other flow moving backward. This would also relate to the Hopi two serpent brothers. One's going one way and one's going the other.
Mm-hmm.
On that one, and this typically when I give the readings, I tell people from my past experience in doing readings for people, it appears that this particular time flow seems to really apply to things from around the year 1998 and after. So it's the type of things that maybe have been getting stronger or more prevalent or powerful in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is showing that that aspect that may be showing up in your life has to do with art, creating things, a lot of things about creation, probably tying into a lot of things connecting in with sun energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular, it's a, in the Mayan thing, it's a Lamot glyph. And if you actually look at the Lamot glyph, it looks almost exactly like, many times, it looks almost exactly like the Hopi shield that appeared on those newsletters, those 44 newsletters. It looks almost exactly like that.
Oh.
It is the eighth day of the Eek cycle. The host here, Blue Otter, was born on 9-Eek, so there's an Eek connection. We found on his show that one way or another, usually almost every one of his guests so far, at least I'd say more than half the time, there's Eek energy showing up.
Which is wind energy storytelling.
Yeah. Communication, spirit, breath, communication, especially about spirit things, spiritual things. Where these two time flows come together, there's a third part to the reading. And in yours, it's a day called 7 IMIX. That has also shown up a lot with people connecting
mm-hmm.
with Blue Otter.
Crocodile.
huh?
That's the crocodile, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
got it. This particular one is symbolizing your pathway or doorway or kind of what you're doing to move from one world cycle to another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not something that just helps you, but helps everybody around you on
mm-hmm.
the entire planet and maybe some other planets too. and this one is speaking about nurturing. Belonging
mm-hmm.
and inspiring others to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Birth of things, natural ways. We've already heard you talking a lot about this, and we could tell by the sound of your voice this was important to you. So this
mm-hmm.
is showing up right here, tuning into things, and energies of synchronicity, movement, and thought. And this 7 IMIX is in the peace cycle. It's the seventh day of the peace cycle. And in many accounts, they say Hopi means peaceful people.
Right.
So the key things here, I think, is many times when I do these readings are not doing anything more really than more or less maybe confirming to people the path that they're already on and maybe give them a little extra help or confidence or whatever to help them just keep going.
Huh.
That's it. And in yours, I would say a lot of things about just keep tuning in, using focusing on the birth natural ways and the peace and the synchronicity and all that stuff. You just keep working on all that, and it's going to work. That's what's going to carry you through one cycle to the next, and you're going to bring along a few other people with you, too.
Okay. Well,
also what's showing up here, too, is the Lamont glyph is also tends to be associated with the planet Venus.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting ready next month to have a Venus transit of the sun, which is considered very important by the Mayans. They watch Venus a lot, and some of their codexes really track all the Venus cycles.
Huh.
So that might be next month when that, I think it's the 6th or the 8th, somewhere in there. You can look it up on the internet. But the transit of the sun by Venus, that might be a powerful time for you. You might pick up some visions that have to do with your future.
Nice. 6th to the 8th.
Somewhere around there, June 6th, 7th, or 8th, somewhere in there. It's the 6th or 8th, I think. Hold on a second. I can probably pull it up here and look it up real quick and see what it is exactly, what day it was. So those are some of the things to maybe keep in mind and may help you out.
Yeah.
Let's see. Venus transit. Boy, I'll make this easy. Trying to find it. Around June 5th. So maybe it's 5th and 6th, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought it was later than that, but saying the 5th here. But you could look it up, too, and just look up June 2012, Venus transit of the sun. Do a search on that on the internet, and you'll be able to read about it a little bit. But that that time period might be good for you with that happening. Might tune in some things.
That's
and the one that the Eat Cliff is also connected in Lord of Wind and Water, and Venus was connected to him as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that... okay, so what's next?
Okay, thank you. Well, here's Alan is 10-12-31, and here he is. Thank you so much. 10-12-31.
10-12-1931.
Yeah, October 12th, 1931.
Well... yours is interesting because you, in the traditional Mayan Dao count, your birth was also on the beginning of a cycle.
Uh-huh.
Hers was on a one chikan, and yours is on a one kan.
Oh.
The kan glyph occurs right before the chikan glyph. Kan is the fourth glyph, and chikan, hers, is the fifth glyph, and you're both born on the first day of each of those cycles. So the energy about great power and force and kind of what the first level of pyramid applies to both of you. So you guys kind of start things and get things going, and when you go together, then things really get working. The Khan glyph itself is things that have a tendency to be able to bring out things that might be hidden. The glyph actually looks like, in most of the representations of it, it looks like a seed being planted into the ground. And in the Mayan tradition, of course, and the Hopi, that would probably be a corn seed.
Yeah.
So we see that that type of energy here. Hers was a red color, yours is a yellow color. So yours is on the, that color ties in with the southern part of a Mayan medicine wheel. And
you mentioned the word bringing out hidden, something hidden, which kind of resonates with me because that my educational video, Prophecy and Pollution, is all of kind of an expose, bringing out, well, actually the flyer, the press release says hidden history, hidden history.
Yeah.
How oil and mining, what oil and mining has done to
fully aware that the atom bombs that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, mm-hmm. the uranium that was in those atom bombs was stolen from the Hopi Reservation.
Yeah, and a lot of workers, Native American workers, particularly Dene, died digging it. As a result of digging it, died from cancer. In the film, that's part of the stuff that we bring out. That people say, like the Dene say, there are no old men. We have no old men. They're all dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true of some other groups. However, well, that there is the I believe it's the Spokane up in Washington. The same thing. That was uranium, and they're still trying to detoxify the place.
Yeah. So we're going to switch over to the other gears, and we're going to look at more from the perspective of the fifth world now, and look at your person like I did with her with the two time flows, a forward flow of time, a backward flow of time, and where the two unify and connect.
Uh-huh.
And in the forward flow, yours is on a day 2 o'clock ball, which is also about dreaming, intuition, challenges, family stuff, goodness of family, and things like that. It is the second day of the Eek cycle. Hers, she was in the Eek cycle on the backward flow of time. So you have energies on the Eek, one moving one way and one moving the other, male and female. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So you have a good ability to work with each other about things spiritual, intuition, dreaming, and you can probably really connect and communicate with each other about that because you have a lot of similar energy there.
Uh-huh.
On the backward flow, there you have a day called 11 Peace. It's one of the new ones, and it's a green glyph, and obviously peace and peaceful people, Hopi. And it has energies associated that kind of go like this. Things about the release of childlikeness, peace, hope, liberation, joy, and forgiveness. We heard that very word earlier several times, mentioned over and over and over when she was talking about that very aspect of forgiveness and how important it was, and it's showing up here now. And this is the type of stuff that, like hers, the backward flow of time, and this is coming from more the perspective of your presence in the fifth world, moving back and connecting with you in the fourth world.
Mm.
And that connection occurring, well, usually I say it's roughly around the year 1998 and stuff going forward, as getting stronger and stronger and stronger.
Mm.
And more something that you can tap into and utilize.
Uh-huh.
And it's coming from that direction. Now, where these two time flows come together, where you have on one side dreaming and intuition moving one way, you have peace and forgiveness moving the other way, they're coming together and emerging and unifying into a third thing. And this one is on a day called 13 Kuwak, and it's about, it has things where it's talking about molding and catalyzing goodness. Family, being present, supernatural power, and ancestors. So ancestors would be maybe an important new thing in this picture to bring in and use.
Uh-huh.
It's the 13th day of the Mulok cycle, which is this particular cycle has a title of cycle of good purification. And I hope he talked about that, too, the day of purification.
Purification, yeah.
So it's suggesting here that things about you being a catalyst for good, but maybe one of the things here that might be an important thing is you might be able to tap into supernatural power with the help and guidance of some ancestors. So, and this particular glyph has also shown up very often with the white buffaloes, the white buffalo calves being born. Many of them have been born on this particular glyph. So I would suggest that you might look into that too, because there might be something there as well. It might even be related to some of the ancestors possibly too.
Hey Mark, you did say one chicken, right?
On hers.
Oh, on hers. Okay. What's his sign? What's his glyph?
His is a one con.
One con?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah,
I was looking at the glyph and one con. That's serpent, right?
No. Con is the fourth glyph. Chikan is serpent. It's the fifth one. So they sometimes people tend to kind of interchange them sometimes.
Okay. Yeah,
and there actually is a connection, because Chakan, the serpent glyph, the tail of the serpent, was a name for the Pleiades, but Khan, his thing, also would relate to the Pleiades, and the reason is one of their names for the Pleiades was Mots, which meant handful of seeds, and the glyph of Khan looks like a corn seed being planted in the ground, so both of them also would have a symbolic connection back into the Pleiades. So that may be the reason you brought it up, is because maybe we need to talk about that a little bit, about both of them having that connection. So you both appear to have some Pleiadian connection energy in the birth.
It's interesting that in the film, again, in Prophecy and Pollution, the beginning is James Kuchangsi is, and his son Dennis, who's grown now. We show them planting corn the Hopi way. We show the planting of the corn. So that's that's a connection.
Yeah, that's very important. It's also important because you're well aware that, you know, the whole Hopi creation emergent story and coming in the world, and the story about the corn there, and, you know, they're using the corn meal, you know, as a sacred thing. And I remember reading about Dan Evahama, and when he was working on the one book, and the writer of the book, what was the name, Thomas Miles or whatever?
Miles.
And he said he really didn't understand why Dan Evahama, you know, had such a problem when he left his land. Because he'd take him, like, in the hotel, and he said, I had a nice hotel. I took him to the best restaurants. And he said it wasn't very long until Dan was saying, I have to get back. I have to get back.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it was only one time when he's out at Dan's house, at his home, and he's standing on his front porch, and Dan goes across the road or whatever path or whatever it was and goes over to his field somewhere, and he comes back with this little baby ear of corn, and he's holding it like a child, like a little baby. And he's standing there, and Dan Evahama's standing there on his front porch with this little ear of corn in his hands, rocking it back and forth and singing to it, just like he would a little baby.
Yeah.
And the writer of the book said it was at that moment that he realized that Dan and the land had blended together, and they were one.
Yeah.
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 So Dan, and the Mayans say that too. The Mayans say that we were, in this certain cycle, we were literally made out of corn. In the Popol Vuh, in the creation story, they say in this cycle we started, and corn was a very important part. And I think the Hopi have something when the child is born too. I believe they have the corn mother, right? Maiden.
Cherokee do too, Mother Salu.
Yeah, and for the first how many days when the Hopi child is is born, they'll put this little ear of corn there. It symbolizes the corn mother.
Yeah.
So you probably I would guess since you're you probably have a connection in the corn mother too.
Yeah, I would say so. Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
We eat a lot of corn too.
Do you grow some in your garden?
Well, we're growing a little now.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Yeah, we finally got a place for a good garden, and we're growing stuff.
Yeah, I got some Hopi corn down there. I got every color imaginable. I even had pink corn.
Wow.
Oh,
and,
yeah
it was pink.
They used to get those blue corn tortillas.
Yeah.
Did you ever eat the peaky bread?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a guy bring me some. I didn't get any when I was down there. But I had another person come up from the Hopi Reservation going up to visit the Lakota, and on his way he stopped through Denver, and I happened to mention to him, I said, I was talking with him, I said, when I was down there I didn't get any peaky bread when I was visiting Grandfather Martin, and I didn't want to ask anybody for some because I didn't feel that was the right thing to do, right? And so I said I was kind of disappointed that I didn't get any, and he said, well,
yeah.
Mark, he said, you're not going to believe this, but when I left, someone came up and gave me a whole box of peaky bread, and he said, now I know why it was given to me, because I'm supposed to give you it. I said, well, you don't give me the whole box. Keep some for yourself. I just need, one or two pieces for me and my wife. So
yeah.
I got some because of that. Yeah, my wife loves it. She thought it was great.
Yeah.
She's from the Philippines.
Hey, does anybody need to take a short pause for the cause?
I'm good.
Okay, just let us know if you need to take a break. Because I've got some good music we can play for a few minutes and whatever you'd like. So, yeah, you guys are on a roll. So yeah, tell us about whatever you want to talk about, Alan. Your new film or reminiscences of the elders or whatever you'd like to talk about.
He's gonna tell you something more, but I just wanted to add something that I'd forgotten. When we were in the village in the winter time, we'd sit in one of the pueblos, and the women in one section and the men would sit in the other, just talking. I mean, they could intermingle if they wanted to, but mainly, during the after the meal, we all sort of separated. And so I remember one time, every night we'd go in, and it was David. He had his loom up, and I was a city girl. I'd worked, Alan and I, we were UCLA modeling, film industry, and those kinds of things. And so when we decided that we wanted to do something more with our lives and got involved in the Traditional Land and Life Committee and began going out to the Hopi Reservation to do the work we were doing, it was new. And so we're sitting in there, and every night I'd watch David. First he spun his wool, and they dyed it. I didn't see that process. But he started spinning, and he made, at the end of a week, he'd woven this belt. It was just lovely. And I thought, gee, that is really lovely. Wonder what do they, I guess they take those and sell them and do something. And he walked over to me and presented it to me. I just couldn't believe it was such a gift, And then, of course, the moccasins that they made where you could not see any stitching. There was no stitching. It was all done from the inside, and they were just done with such precision, and so much care went into them, and he gave me a pair of the moccasins. And I was just remembering that. And the women, we'd sit, and the women did a lot of the clay. And one of the women had, they made bowls. And I'm not sure if you know much about pottery, but you work on a wheel, and everything is, very even and balanced. And when you do it by hand, it's not always quite as precise. Well, they gave me a bowl that was so well constructed. It was so beautiful, and it was all handmade. It was totally balanced and just so lovely. And so just those gifts, those simple gifts, and just sitting there in that pueblo where they kept the fire going so it was comfortable and warm, and everybody sat and talked about whatever we talked about, you know. That was many, many, many years ago. But I just remember that, how special that was. Anyway, I'm going to now pass the phone to Alan.
Thank you. Thank you for your, really appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Yes, I, the film is actually, it's really a culmination of more than 50 years of our connection with the Hopi and the problems out there. We had the first. It's three parts. The first part is short, maybe 9 minutes. It's called Autobiography of a Hopi, and it's the autobiography on film of James Coots, or Coots Shanxi, and it tells his story and tells something of the way the Hopi view. And then the second part, because we were limited in what we could film. In fact, we couldn't film legally on the Hopi reservation. The opening shot, which is a long a shot from a car moving through the traditional village of Hauteville, I was shot by myself. I was in a cardboard box in the back seat of our car. My wife was in the front seat driving. I was in a cardboard box with a hole cut in it that I could stick the camera lens through. It was a reflex Rolex 16mm camera, so I could look right through the lens and see out, but I couldn't see anything else. And the reason I was in there, because there was no filming on the reservation. And we actually did this, I don't know, nobody was up. It must have been 4 or 5, it was just daybreak, right when the sun came up. Nobody was out on the road, so that's how we shot that long shot. The other shots, James and I did out, and his son, Dennis, we did out on the farm. It's about the planting of corn and so on. And then we got some footage of dances at a Pueblo dance where they filming what the only place where filming of dances was allowed. So since New Mexico, but the next section, so the next section we did with actors to show the prophecy and the conflict with the invasion of oil and mining corporations. We presented we did one version of full-length feature film, which was received a Neptune Award at the Moon Dance Festival, but we wanted to do education, something educational. That was a feature drama. We wanted to do something educational, so we shortened that and put it together with the autobiography of Hopi, and we had an educational theme called Techua Apache, and we completed that. And then, as I said, I didn't take the Hopi prophecy as really a true prophecy. I thought they were just exaggerating. But then I began seeing on the internet and elsewhere footage that was being gathered of the effects of oil and mining on indigenous people, and particularly Native Americans. And so we thought we wanted to add that the coming true of the prophecy, to make the full information available, and that's the third part that makes up Prophecy and Pollution, which is an 80-minute educational film. We are seeking to get into schools, in particular college. I don't know how many high schools are ready for it, but hopefully we could get into colleges so that students will see what's really going on. I think these images need to be seen. They're not entertaining, but they're true, and they're what maybe a particularly sheltered American middle-class students should be exposed to, because they maybe can't imagine how bad things can get in the third world. Oh, here, my wife wants to add some.
Hi, it's Gwen again.
Hi.
I just wanted to piggyback on something Alan had said earlier about why he was hiding in the box in the, you know, when he was taking the photograph. Because, you know, so many tourists will go to those areas, photograph people as without respect, with, you know, not even getting permission, and then they used to put them on postcards and sell them like they were some oddity, that they weren't people that had feelings. And so, of course, the Hopi did not like that and didn't appreciate it, and so there was no filming allowed also, because their village was their sacred place. It was their home. And so, you know, they'd be all on these postcards. And what we did, we just showed a little bit of the village, but not people, just so the viewers could get some idea. We showed what the road was like, where they had to drive over. If you'll notice in the film, you'll see how that road was like an impossible road to drive on. And we did that in a respectful manner, even though we, you know, we just got a little footage of the village so the viewer could have a basic idea. But we didn't really photograph people. We wouldn't have done that without their permission. But that's what people tend to do. A lot of people come and they just treat people in third worlds and other places as if they don't have feelings, you know. It just treats them without any regard, no respect, and it's just, it's not okay. That's what I guess I'm trying to say. Okay, I'm going to pass the phone back to Alan.
Okay, well, the film, I said the full three parts are merged in this film we call Prophecy and Pollution, and it's on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon. The DVDs we're aiming at colleges, so there are though downloads. They're quite cheap. On Amazon. I think you can look at it for $1 or something like that.
Yeah, and there's a clip. You can see a clip of it on your one of your websites.
Yeah, there's a clip there on IndieFlix, I know. It sells downloads and has a trailer there to look at. So, yeah, we're mainly hoping that teachers and instructors and professors will use it. I don't expect it to go in. It's not for theaters. The stimulate discussion, really. It's intended to be provocative. So, I mean, if I as an instructor, I was a teacher for many years, I would like a film like that brings out startling information and makes statements that are unusual and previously hidden. Well, I think that I would like that to provoke discussion. But I think a lot of instructors are just thinking about hanging on to their jobs and not making waves. So anyway, we'll see. I'm trying to get it out there to the colleges. Yeah. Well, the
Well, that's great. Well, I'm going to give you a plug, and you put up a link over this URL is permanent, and so people that visit your website can listen to this interview.
Oh, okay.
But I also see that you were an early protester of and active in herbal rights. We shall sell, shall we say? If you want to go into it, fine. But I was looking around for stuff about Alan Kent George and I was reading about some of the stuff you were doing back in the 50s. You're pretty brave back then to be involved with green medicine. lots changed in California.
I don't remember particularly. Do you remember?
In the 50s,
I was in school, actually in college.
That's not you.
That might be another.
I don't think that was me. No.
Must be somebody else. It was at Berkeley. Up at Berkeley, and okay. Anyway.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I was involved some kind of way. I don't know. But
that's okay. It's all right. But so have you this film? I see it's getting some pretty good reviews. Has it been seen at any of the film festivals?
It was at the Al Jazeera Documentary Festival. That's in the Middle East, and it was in the Green Screen Environmental Film Festival in Venice, California. It was in the Surge Film Festival in Austin, Texas. Presents films mainly films with a message, films that have something to say, and it was in the Third World International Film Festival also.
Good. That's
so
good.
It's quality film. It's not. It's. And I have, of course, my history. I went to UCLA. I got a Master of Fine Arts from the Motion Picture Division of the Theater Arts Department. So, and I've been working. Well, I've been earning my living mainly by teaching, but I've also been doing films for 60 years.
Yeah, it looks like you're, I guess the first book you authored was the 70s, and Encounters with Aboriginal Philosophers, Proof That God Exists.
I remember I wrote those. Yeah, they've been around for. Never been around for a while. My most recent book is called Looking for the Real Thing. It's a YA novel, as they call it, a young adult novel for teenagers, about a teenager who wants to basically have get out of town and have a more peaceful, harmonious life, kind of connection with nature. And he gets, and his, it's the book's the process of him going through high school and dealing with all the things that his friends are dealing with. And finally, he, all the temptations and all the actions and he finally breaks loose in the end, and I made it to, because I thought there are probably a few teenagers out there who felt that way and may feel a little isolated because none of their friends do, or most people don't.
Yeah.
And that's Looking for the Real Thing. I believe it's on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and so on. Yeah,
there's all you got to do is just Google Alan Kent George and And there's a ton of stuff out there.
Oh, I'm infamous, huh?
Yeah. No, it's just all about your books and, you know, buy.com, Amazon, and different libraries that have your books and films.
Oh, good.
And critical.
Yeah, I do that sometime, I guess.
Yeah, you got to take a look. You got to take a look.
Yeah,
so,
I did a long time ago.
Did they ever take you out to Prophecy Rock?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they Dan Kachunga and James took David. They took us out there, and they were saying that's what they prophecy, and they wanted to film about it.
They, I understand from reading in Zula's book, God's Chosen People in America, that at one point it was in danger of being bulldozed or
oh, really? Yeah.
Or because they're going to put the road through.
Yeah.
And they're thinking about just blowing it up, you know, to get it out of the way. And
oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true, yeah.
But yeah,
I think it's still there, though.
What did, yeah, it is. What do you remember about a certain item that the Hopi buried? Was it in Houghton Villa? And they said if this thing was ever dug up, you know, when they were putting in utilities or something, it would signal that they're getting pretty close to the end. Yeah, it's I was reading that in the Hopi Survival book, what Thomas Males did. I don't know, 15 years ago, and it was a pretty good book. And but you're right. Yeah, there's been, you know, between the Hopi and Rolling Thunder, they made a lot of noise back in the 60s.
Yeah, I remember Rolling Thunder. Yeah, he was good.
Oh, yeah. Tell us. I didn't meet him until 1990. Oh, tell us what you remember about it.
I don't remember too much about it. I remember except, you know, I can, you know, recall his image and everything. And he'd come to, I know he came to some of our gatherings, and he was, I remember he was on a tribal council, which I thought, gee, well, some tribal councils may be okay then. Because I had been experienced with the Hopi tribal council, which was the so-called progressives, which were the, the destroyers. The traditionals, of course, did not believe in voting. They didn't believe that a...
Oops, I think the call's been dropped, folks. We're going to call him back. Now, let's see. Just hang on a minute, folks. We'll call him back. First, I got to get the call dropped and... Yeah, sorry, but we're back.
Oh, okay.
Hey, yeah, so they were again voting.
Yeah, they of course they ruled by consensus, and they would go down, like I said, in their kiva and work out the problem. Nobody could come out and everybody agreed. But then when it's ironic, the Democrats, they always talk bad about it. I think Collier was the name of this Secretary of the Interior, I guess it was, or the BIA. Anyway, he was the guy, and they always talk bad about him because he brought in the tribal councils, the traditional, you know, which was not traditional, and everything was by voting, and the traditionals wouldn't even participate.
Yeah, but, you know, BIA, there was the BIA Council is what it was. And
yeah,
that was forced on them, you know, back in the 30s, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, yeah. And they, it's ironic. There's liberal Democrats introduced that thing.
Yeah, well, back in the 30s, I can't remember the name of the act, but it was an act where they basically, because World War One, you know, they realized, you know, they needed... Indians to fight in the army, so They decided after treating them like prisoners of war for a long time, in 1934, I believe, that they were going to pass an act going to make Native American citizens. But what they did, the trickster part was, as they said it to the tribal councils, and they said, if you can say no to this, but if we don't hear from you by a certain drop-dead date, you know, you're saying you agree with this. And they didn't hear from the Hopi, because back then they were, or back in the 30s, they were, oh my gosh, not
organized. I remember pictures of...
Anyway, so they you know, they got screwed that way.
And I remember pictures of Hopi in chains in a prison. I don't know, forget where the prison was, some of the Hopi traditional leaders back in those days. Forget the date, but
well, Thomas Bunyaki went to prison rather than fight.
Yeah, right. This was way earlier when they had, I think, in 19, the famous date. I think 1906. They said something like that. There was a big conflict, and the traditionals were expelled.
Mm-hmm. That was the break.
Oribe, and that's when the village of Hauteville was founded. Yep. The village.
The factions that developed between the hostiles and the hostiles and the friendlies, they were called.
But that's when Hauteville came into existence, and I guess it's still there now. And I haven't been there in years, but it was the traditional village.
Yeah, the I'm looking at an article is talking about the split at Oribe, an Oribe account. So the American occupation of the Southwest in 1846 marked the beginning of government intervention in Hopi affairs. Besides land policies that radically decreased the boundaries of Hopi lands, the newly introduced government schools had severe consequences for Hopi society. U.S. government took Hopi children away from their families, sometimes against their parents' will. The children were sent to boarding schools and... you can Google the split at Oribe and Oribe account. Kind of interesting. Yeah, there was no violence, but there was pushing and shoving.
Yeah. Well, the Hopi never engaged in violence except, I think, one time. It's in the history books. In the Spanish occupation, they rose up one night against the Spanish, and... I don't know the details on it, but they Spanish. Got
they
rid of the Spanish. Of course, the Spanish just came back.
Right.
But they haven't tried any kind of violence since.
They got together with the Puebloans, because they're Puebloan people. But see, the Hopi knew that there were different waves of white people that would be coming, and the first wave they knew would be destructive, and these people would wear hats that looked like backs of turtles. And they drove them out late 1500s. But they said that the next group of people that would come would wear flat-brim black hats, and that they would come with the symbol of the cross. But if they came with a cross that had one leg longer than the other, then they would be out of balance.
Oh.
And if they had more of the Celtic... Druidic, version of Christianity, which the early church father Origen commented, and he liked, the Druids, and if they'd have had that Druidic attitude about,
I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, that was one of their prophecies.
The Druids, I'm not really familiar with the Druids.
Yeah, they were an earth-based religion, basically. But that's not the way things worked out, and thanks to Rome. Still fighting that Roman system.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's come down to us. The Roman Empire selected they selected the structure for the Catholic Church and the whole society.
They sure did, and people don't know the history of, if they go back and, the best book to get is Tony Bushby's book, The Bible Fraud. It's a real page turner and an eye opener. And a full one third of the book is bibliography, and it talks about what a total fraud they were. And I guess there was a few hundred, basically. Yeah, early Christianity was, a lot of fraudsters and tricksters, and when they all got together at Nicaea to decide that they were going to settle on, certain doctrines and dogma, and there was a riot that broke out, and they had to call in several thousand troops to break up the riot, and a lot of people don't realize, they think the Christian church is 2,000 years old. It's not. It's only 1,600 years old.
And they, as I understand it, the Constantine and the others that were setting this up, they chose one particular group of all the Christian groups calling them Christians because of its organizational structure. They wanted control, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the church and the bishops and archbishops and all that organization was what they wanted, because they wanted to just the whole idea of control.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's I guess they wanted to control his riots, but they set it up. The main thing is the organization. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with Jesus. I mean. Christianity,
yeah.
You're not.
There was
if
invented
it had anything to do
with
Jesus, they wouldn't kill anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, you imagine
it was
Jesus
invented
killing
by Paul.
Somebody?
Yeah,
I mean,
it was basically invented by Paul. And did you ever hear the story of the reported death of Dan Kachangwa?
Uh huh.
Did you ever hear that story?
No,
No one ever found his body, but he walked up into the hills, and there was. A flying shield, which is what the Hopi called UFOs, seen in that area. That was reported in the Prescott Courier. And did any of them ever tell you stories about Space Brothers or anything like that?
Oh, they didn't tell us stories, but I understand they'd had experiences up there. Yeah, I never we never got into the details. We weren't focusing on that, but they did have some kind of experiences from what I understood.
Yeah, there's a good, Robbie Robertson did a song called The Lights, and it's, you get a chance, you might listen to it sometime, and, let me know if you need a break. I'm good, but we've been going an hour and a half now, and, you have a
stronger. So we got what, 30 minutes to go?
Yeah. You have a stronger bladder than I do, and you're 23 years older. So hey, you're doing real well.
Depends. Some days are different from others. You know?
That's nice to get to know you. Where in the islands do you live?
We live on Maui. Up country, as they say. I don't know if you're familiar with Maui at all, but
Is it in the Ko'olau area, the real beautiful area?
Well, it's beautiful, but now this is Kula is the name of the place where we live. It's we're about, I don't know, between 3,000 and 4,000 feet up the Haleakala, supposedly extinct volcano, and we like it because it's so hot down by the down lower and there's also they still have sugar cane here, and they burn the sugar cane sometimes when they harvest, and they've got a lot. This island is like two mountains with a valley in between.
Mm-hmm.
The valley in between is a large part sugar cane. And when they burn it, the air gets really bad down there. And also, there's a volcano on the big island, which is next to Maui. And the that's been erupting continuously since, I don't know when, we were here in the 1970s, and it wasn't erupting at that time, but it's since then, I guess it was in the 80s, it started and it has never stopped, it continues to erupt. And those bog fumes, as they call them, VOG, will come too. And so the elevation up here keeps us to a large extent out of that.
So, what's the name of the little town you live near?
Kula, K-U-L-A.
Oh, I see. Okay, so yeah, you're not too far from the town of Maui, and
Maui is an island. There's the town. The big main town is called Kahului, K-A-H-U-L-U-R.
Yeah, right. Yeah, where the airport is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're up near the Makawau Forest Reserve.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Makawau is between Kula and Kahului. Yeah. It's kind of.
I'll bet it's gorgeous. And yeah. I was reading about it here. It said that the scent of eucalyptus in the air, I'll bet you get a nice garden growing up there.
Oh yeah, we're doing well, and we're working on it, and it's a beautiful area, and it's not. I mean, I would just as soon be further out in the country and have acreage and stuff, but. That's not too much. Maui is kind of crowded. Plus, we work, particularly my wife, at the college in Kahului. So she has to drive to work, and I once in a while myself.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have income. So you can't live. At this point, too far.
Yeah, it's expensive to live there. And how long ago did you move there?
Well, we originally moved there. We got married, I believe, in 1963, and we started out in Ocean Park, actually, is where we were at the time, and. We experienced a lot of, because my wife is African American, we experienced discrimination, and so we thought we'd try Hawaii, and we came here. We found it is quite different. It was at that time. And then the problem was that we had five children. We had four just before we came here. We had the fourth, and then we had the fifth one in Hawaii. Matter of fact, I delivered the last two myself in her house and houses, and so we had five children, and it was a question of income. I remember reading the statistics, for instance, for the city of Honolulu. Compared to all other cities in the United States, has the highest rents and the lowest wages. It's Hawaii. I mean, everything in Hawaii costs more, but it's tougher to get a job.
Yeah, yeah.
We had trouble for five children, so we went back to California because we could get better work, more work, and. Make more money there, and that's what we did, and we raised the children there. And when the opportunity came, my wife getting this job, she took it, and I came too, and we were happy to get back here.
Wow, I'm looking at pictures of, Kula, which in Hawaii means plain field, open country, pasture, and dry land farming rather than it's a beautiful place. There's a driving tour of upcountry Maui, and yeah, it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah,
rich
taro
and sweet potato, and wow.
Yeah.
So how long ago were you able to move back?
Oh, we've been back. My wife. Let me see. Yeah, my wife has been back now for just about 2 years, and I came a couple of months after. We've been going on 2 years here. We lived down in Wailuku, which is next to Kahului. We always wanted, that's really in town. I mean, that's not in country at all. We wanted to get out of town. We didn't.
Yeah.
We didn't. And that's why we left L.A. We were going to get out of town.
Yeah.
And Kahului is, it's quite busy. I mean, it's a city. It's not as big as Honolulu. My wife went to Honolulu this weekend for a book fair. She's an author, and she was describing it. I mean, in the years since we lived there shortly for a short while on Oahu in Honolulu when we were here before, and she says, "Boy, it's just gotten incredible. It's huge skyscrapers. It's like a any huge city you'd see on the mainland. Dams, freeways, and
I see." She's got a book called I Am the Blues.
Yeah, right. It's a children's book. It's a children's picture book. And the pictures are really paintings very well done. African artist.
I'll look around and see if I can grab a picture of her and put it on the little website for the show. I grabbed some pictures from your... information that's on the net about your current movie, but that's good. It's got a really nice cover.
Hey, baby, he's looking at your book. Do you have your picture on the internet anywhere?
I'm looking at Author's Den. There you go. I see you.
Awesome. Yeah, Author's Den. Yeah, she should be in there.
There we go. I got one. Okay.
My book's in there, too. Looking for the real thing.
Yeah, I've got a picture of you up on there, and I'll get one of her up on there, too. Yeah, very attractive lady. I can see why you fell in love with her. Where was she born?
She was born in Texas.
Oh, yeah, whereabouts?
San Antonio.
Oh, is that right? Huh.
Yeah.
Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. I was out in the garden.
I had my grandfather and his seven brothers and sisters were all born and raised in Texas, and I have ties to Texas and Louisiana. And San Antonio. Yeah, I've got a good picture. Looks like you are wearing what looks like a brocade blouse.
Okay.
It's beautiful. Looks like silk Chinese blouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well,
I'll get that up on there for you. We were just talking about Hawaii. And, my first wife had an interesting experience. She went, after her father passed away, she went over there for a visit.
Uh-huh.
And she was at the big shopping center there.
Ala Moana?
Ala Moana.
Uh-huh.
And she was picking up and looking at something and wondering whether she could afford it. And the spirit told her, put it down, go home, get your affairs in order, you're moving here.
Yes.
And so she went home, and within a month she was back.
Yeah.
And you know, she found a place to live and a job the first day, and that's impossible.
Yeah,
they usually take at least 6 months to find a place to live and a job there.
Yeah,
and so she moved into the Makiki area.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And absolutely loved it. You know, fell right in with the culture.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Nearly married a fellow by the name of Russell Watanabe,
uh-huh.
But her. I guess she lived there for about 2.5 years, and her pastor started telling her, it's time for you to go home. And three times he told her, and the third time says, if you don't go back now, you're going to miss him.
Wow.
And she got back to Salt Lake in September of 2000, or 1996, and I arrived in the following January.
Right.
And but she was 8 years older than I was, you know, and
yes,
so
yes.
I was trying to fix my roommate up with her, and we all went to a production of Harvey the Pooka.
Uh-huh.
And I found out what fun she was, and so, you know, I started sitting there and talking to her. We started dating. I think we were married 5 weeks later.
Wow. And you of course realized there are no accidents, right?
Oh no. Well, the funny thing about it was, yeah, I had, you know, had the, I was 21 at the time, and had the usual, you know, run of girlfriends, and I stepped off the curb. I was heading for the little place where I was living, and I had this strong thought to come to my head. Just as I stepped off this curb, it wasn't an audible voice, but it just occurred to me, you're going to be married in a place very near here for the third week in March.
Yes.
And that's, you know, so, and then I forgot all about it. Well, really what I thought at the moment was, you know, get thee behind me, Satan. I don't want anything to do with women. So,
Yeah. Then
we met and got married. We were gonna wait until June, but we moved it up to the 24th of August or
uh-huh,
March.
Uh-huh.
And then conference was the last week of March. And so I stepped off that heading back into the area. I stepped off the curb with her,
yes.
And I froze and I said, "You wouldn't believe what happened." Well, the interesting thing was that crosswalk that we were in led to the Boulevard grass strip that was in front of the house that we got married in.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's sort of what I was saying about the Hopi and the rhythm and the balance, because I think if we observe those rhythms and stay in balance, it to us it just seems like a big deal. Like she was given the word to move back, and I mean, it's all so synchronistic, and we think in terms of, wow, that's really amazing. And I think if we're in tune, if we just slow down, we get all the answers, all the direction, but it's a matter of wanting that to happen and just slowing down in our lives. Everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but many people just rushing about, just rushing here, rushing there. And what is the objective of all that rushing about? It's mainly to get money. To be able to buy more things.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what the Hopi, I think, we're trying to tell people. Just slow down a bit.
Yeah.
Just slow down.
Well, you know, she was.
What you need will always present itself.
That's
just,
right.
You
well,
just slow down and listen and just.
She's the one that started me on this path, you know, the whole concept of, you know, following the spirit was like, what? You know?
Yeah.
And she taught me how to read the feelings and. And
yes.
And to listen to, you know, what was going on in my inner dialogue and everything, and she was amazing. And but she in 1982 woke up one morning in March, and I heard a voice that said that an attempt was going to be made on her life during the dark of the moon.
Oh,
and six and nothing happened that weekend, but the 6 weeks later, she had a checkup, and they noticed. A lump in her breast, and it was precancerous, but they took the breast anyway. And then they took a second breast in 1989, and then she, we thought, you know, she was clear, but back in those days, you know, you had a 10% chance of surviving past 10 years, and she lived 13, but she did die during the dark of the moon 13 years later.
Yeah.
And it was really amazing. But she, you know, she told me, "Hey, I'm gonna hang around because we had a boy."
Yeah.
It was 9 then, and whenever any serious challenge was gonna happen in my life, she'd always show up.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen her many times. You know, she's very close.
Yeah.
And, it really is amazing. If people just learn to listen to the spirit, I mean, this is something that Native people really take advantage, you know, take for granted, and it's too bad. I work with Red Elk a lot, and he's taught 10,000 people, you know, how to get a dialogue with the Creator. He's only had a handful come back and report they actually did it, which is really sad.
Mm-hmm, Yeah. Well, people are, I think, so tuned in to what they, I don't know. I don't even know anymore. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just realize at my age, I have no answers, you know.
Yeah.
I really don't understand so much. I'm as far as being an intelligent woman and understanding and reading books and do that, I know that. But some of the other things that go on this planet, I have no explanation as to why people, why we are in the 21st century and we still have wars. It's beyond me. You know, it's beyond me. And I just wonder, well, who are we dealing with? Who exactly? What exactly is going on? And then when I start asking all those questions, it's like right now I go out to my garden and I work with my plants.
Yeah.
You know, because trying to figure out all this craziness, you know, all this, it's just, I just decided, no, I'm just going to work in my garden and be a really good example at whatever I do. Just be a good example in my everyday, every moment. Just be a good example. And that's what I live to do. And Alan and I, we live to be really good examples in all that we do. And that's what we've taught our children. And no, we're not perfect. We make a lot of mistakes. And we just try to not continue to make the same mistake over and over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
At least if we have to make mistakes, let's make some new ones. Let's not just
repeat
the same insanity.
When did Alan's ancestors get to the United States?
They came, let me ask him, because, hold on. Here we go. Let's see.
Yeah, you're...
When did your ancestors get to the United States?
They came from Germany, and I think it's about 1840s. I think it was part of the... I think 1848. I'm not too familiar with German history. I guess I should... to study it more, but I know there was a turnover in 1848. I believe the conservative, or the royalty or something, took the country back, and the democratic people a lot of them came to the United States. Anyway, that's about the time they came.
Where did they move to in the United States?
Well, eventually they went to, I think they went to New York first, and then eventually Missouri.
Mm.
And they, I think it was the city, Union City, Missouri. They, I remember.
I know there's quite a few German people that ended up in Missouri. Yeah, I was just kind of curious.
There was a German, they told me there's a German quarter in St. Louis where it's, you know, like they have a Latin quarter, a ghetto. Well, they had a German quarter at that time. I doubt if they have it now, but it is at that time. But then the city, I think it was Union City, the family, somebody in the family had a big, I think they had a lot of money in a big building that burned down, and they lost their money, something like that. But that's the area, and they wound up eventually in St. Louis. That's where my folks lived and were.
Yeah, it's halfway between St. Louis and Cuba, you know, near Rolla. That's a beautiful area. Oh, gorgeous. Yeah, it's a beautiful place, and a lot of good farming there. And I was just kind of curious, you know, her being African American, the chances of her having native blood's like 70%. It's almost certain that she's got some native blood. And who knows, you know, with your great grandparents getting here that early, you know, you may have, you never know, especially if you look at
your family. Well, I do have a more recently. I've never met him, but my brother told me that I had some, I don't know if it was an uncle or someone who was Native American. Somebody married somebody, I know, that we have.
A lot of Cherokees in Missouri, a lot of them. A lot of them. Well, listen.
Yeah.
I need to.
We probably have somebody.
I'm gonna be adding in editing the show a little bit, and do need to let you go. But I really appreciate you guys coming on the show, and good. This invention of the internet. It's kind of cool, and
yeah, everything has its good and its bad sides. There are a lot of good things about. I love the internet. The connections and the connecting with people and for instance in film, you have a chance to do something, whereas before the internet unless you connected with a big wheel or a big organization, it was tough to do anything with film. But here you can, at least you have a chance to connect with people. And I appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's everything has, two sides to it.
Thanks. Thanks for being with us. And
thank you. I've enjoyed it, and I've learned a few things too, and I appreciate your consideration.
Well, thanks a lot, and folks, we'll be doing some interviews during the week. We rebroadcast interviews that we did from the past, and we'll have some new live guests next weekend. And want to thank everybody, and we're gonna roll the outro music. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing, and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Tell me all. whispers of great wisdom, truth of other times.